What I want to do is read in two halves. I'm going to, in the first half, read stuff mainly from, in fact, completely from my recent book called All the Wrong Notes. And in the second half, I'm going to read more recent work, including the pamphlet which has been brought out by this, you know, especially for this series. Okay. The first two pieces I want to read were originally published and conceived as two posters forming a diptych, which I did with the Brighton artist Ian Brown. The two of them, which combine visuals and text scattered over them and in amongst the visuals, were like to face one another and to contradict one another. This is the text for the first poster. It's the vase of tulips and a mirror trick. Though this time the vase is not set between facing mirrors, but between a mirror and a painting of a mirror with a vase of tulips. And this in turn photographed. It's the beautifully printed exhibition note in front of a Korean bowl that has been placed on burnt umber hessian. It quotes Bernard Leach's praise of the unself-conscious asymmetry of Korean potters and how nothing in nature is symmetrical, but everything is asymmetrical, a nose not perfectly straight, the eyes not perfectly level. It's those dreams of perfection. The man of your dreams, woman of your dreams, the budgie of your dreams. Your dreams come true to a jarring chorus of cash registers and half-stifled moans. Again and again and again and again. And the months and years glide by, hardly noticed, so heavy and dull is the obsession. To raise your head for one moment clear of this, skies and clouds ahead and the fields and cities below as you fly through the sunlight. And below, not looking up, are you going to see the new gorillas? He asked as we walked briskly towards the Jardin des Plantes. A cold, dry day in January, with mist on the downs, frost on the furrows and ice on the ponds. A flock of partridges suddenly starting up in front of me and whirring off to the left, skimming the ploughed fields. But André Gide wrote, the strange mental cowardice which makes us perpetually doubt whether future happiness can equal past happiness is often our only cause for misery. We cling to the phantoms of our bereavements as if we were in duty bound to prove to others the reality of our sorrow. We search after memories and wreckage. We would like to live the past over again. We want to reiterate our joys long after they're drained to the dregs. I hate every form of sadness and cannot understand why trust in the beauty of the future should not prevail over worship of the past. And the facing poster. The texts were like collage, and so were the posters. This first poster had small pictures of 1950s Hollywood starlets and budgerigars and things like that, all sort of stuck as though they'd been put on a wall. The second poster. Sleepers awake from the sensible life whose only passion is hatred. A red and black pagoda towers above the chestnut trees in a royal botanic garden. The lush greens of South London back gardens. Oh, summer nights when trembling with that ecstasy, our bodies sweat and flood one another's. burst forth, sun streams forth, light, all doors and windows magically thrown open, a hot, lush meadow outside with dark green woods at its edges. Turn to another way. These are insistences, not repetitions, or the repetitions are only the insistence on, and it all crowds in, nostalgia for the life of others, whereas ours, seen from the inside, seems broken up. We're still chasing after an illusion of unity. Separation is the rule. The rest is chance. Which way to step? And the dull brutality of monsters as they grind the bones, forbidden to delight one's body, to return to the truth of things. The clouds part. Your hand reaches through. Yes, the glow and light in us, our bodies. And below, around us, the Flint Customs House at Shoreham, the call of a cuckoo as we climb uphill to the stalled-down stone row, the wild moor about, and from its edges the churches, cathedrals, ancient and beautiful things. Talking to myself, the sweet qualities of our dreams without which, how the wind blows and our hearts ache to follow the hazardous route the winds follow. 6 million Russians, 6 million Jews, 2 million Poles, 1 million Serbs, Gypsies and others. I want to read after that a sequence in five parts, which is for Paul Evans. This was based very much on, not based on, but sparked by a series of postcards that were sent to me. So the first postcard. A rock outcrop in the sea. A deserted car standing on the empty shore road. Gulls shriek in the air above the rock, while below thrift and small orchids flower in that awesome hush between the waves breaking. The blue leather upholstery of the car is too hot to touch, the sun being that bright and strong today. A neat green cardboard box has been placed on the back seat. The scent of the sea and the coast join somewhere up there in the sky, a pyramid of light. Or would you be bored by all this after the first day? The ground too damp and civilization too far away? What if it rains and you have to trudge miles to the nearest shop or pub or public transport to get away from all this, to have a few decent home comforts? Number two. 1900. Hold the horses! It's Hotel Wolf, or as they now say in these modern times, Wolf Hotel, and since then renamed the Sisson, Saratoga, Wyoming. Step inside, to the palm-filled lounge and big easy chairs, and just the right soupçon of barbarism. Oh, cold-blooded murderers, the sweethearts and glory of this continent. Peaches, fresh peaches, cried the two gauchos. And the little boy, lifting the canvas that covered their fruit cart, saw only a heap of severed heads. You do step into the bar, but are rightly nervous beneath your assured and sporty manner. No tennis courts here, I'm sorry to say. Only childlike card games played by unpleasant adults. I wouldn't stay long if I were you, though I'm not. Three. I turn my back on all that and re-enter the alchemist's dark chambers. A glass prism is set on the tabletop beneath the window and scatters sunlight in bands of colour, a marvel to behold. Books, equipment and implements are stacked about the room, all as aids to discover the wonders and secrets of nature through human invention and curiosity, godlike. A stuffed baby crocodile hangs from the ceiling. The resort glows gold with its fire. Dear sir, your moods of deep depression can weigh heavily on you for several days or more. I can really do very little for you or your state. Such melancholy can take up to 6 years to fade from your heart after the original emotional shock. I would suggest you're taking long walks in the countryside and that you try to mix socially as much as is possible. Signed, a doctor. 4. To spell it out, the barbarity in all its forms, in the face of which our blundering frailty, our frail giant steps. This book, wrote the French resistance leader Colonel Georges, springs from a sadness and a certain amount of disgust at seeing myths take so much precedence over history. Our truth has no need of mirrors that would exaggerate it. And you, Anna, with your two fierce-looking sisters and presumably stories of real hardships and dangers in the now placid Midwest, or even further west, Kansas maybe, it's different somehow, though I can't explain. Families on all sides of the water, with their own strengths, like islands in the flood, us all sat on top of the roof like a bunch of drenched chickens waiting for the waters to subside and then be submerged again within the family. It's difficult to explain, warming and frightening at the same time, the love there. There are the grand events, the dangerous times when maybe more than a rightness about a family is needed. Though I can't say we live in such times, and even so, any such dramatic behaviour has to have a base camp somewhere, n'est-ce pas? Though maybe not. The last postcard. 5. Paul, you must know it already, but how in the upper left margin of the first page of the manuscript score for the 4th of July, Charles Ives wrote to his copyist, "Mr. Price, please don't try to make things nice. All the wrong notes are right. Just copy as I have. I want it that way." You walk by the sea on a grey February afternoon with your daughter Lucy and a grossly over-enthusiastic dog. On our meeting we remember, though don't talk of it, the obviously lucid and witty conversation we had the night before when, somewhat the worse for drink. The mistakes, the difficulties. These words almost used too much so they become some sort of totem or excuse. But it all falling in us too every which way. In a little frequented corner of the museum, we find an old and heavily embroidered trade union banner on display. The gold silk on a dark red velvet background shows a motif of clasped hands. And all of this faded and somewhat the worse for wear too. I can't make out the motto, but it's probably something like strength in unity, or... Out in the street again, we head back towards the beach. The sea really is magnificent. A vast sweep of silver-shot slate-grey that fades off and up into the white-grey of the sky. The chilling sea wind grips our bones. Right. Now I want to read four shorter poems. Piece called Just Friends. Two men enter a Victorian house in Kensington and view a recreated Arab courtyard and a series of indifferent paintings. Two men sit by Kensington Round Pond on a chilly autumn day and discuss the birds and animals to be found in cities. Two men and a woman sit on the swaying top deck of a bus driving along the coast road from New Haven to Brighton on a November afternoon. Three men and two women stop to pick up large redskin potatoes that had fallen from a farm lorry and then continue on their walk to see a tree full of herons and a lone kestrel perched on a footpath sign. Two men walk on a summer evening through the leafy streets of West London and discuss renting a studio. Two men stride along Hadrian's Wall in March and are met by earnest hikers in orange anoraks and woolly hats. Two men walk by the sea at night. Two men in the dark of a hide quietly lift the wooden flaps and observe the mudflats below them, the curlews, dunlins, grey plovers, cormorants, shell duck, redshanks and herons. Two men in Essex study an ancient church door with graceful ironwork, said to be Viking in origin. Two men wave to one another, figuratively, at a great distance, real, and slowly fade from each other's sight. Two men write letters to each other and meet, ride a motorbike, drive in a hired car, and take long train journeys north. Two men scramble over a recent cliff fall, searching for flints and fossils, and then fade in the sea mist. One man, the lush parks and mute statues. At this point I feel close to tears. Piece titled Claret. Yes, so you're seeing the opposite, in the second half. It was sparked by a picture on a wine label. Most of my work I collaborate with, not most of it, but I'm very interested in collaborating with other art forms, using other stuff around. There's a French writer, Raymond Roussel, who wrote a marvelous book called La Vue, which consists of three prose pieces. For instance, one of them is him sitting in a restaurant and he has a bottle of mineral water on the table and he looks at it and he goes into the picture and walks around the scene portrayed on the label on the mineral water bottle. And the end of the story, after meeting various people and seeing various sights, comes out again back into the restaurant table. And this starts with a rather ordinary sort of bottle of claret, but goes elsewhere. The large grey chateau, isolated in the middle of lawns and pastures that extend beyond reason. A large dark grey building, put to the cruel uses its exterior already suggests. A Gestapo headquarters, interrogation rooms and cells. The top window on the left, almost exactly halfway between the end of the building and the main entrance. Though this is in my imagination, in a sun-filled kitchen in the early afternoon in September, where such interrogations could equally happen, husband and wife piling up cruelly logical absurdities, complaints and accusations while the babies cry in the next room. Monsters and co. The top window on the left of a slum tenement, seen from the train window passing through East London, Bethnal Green, Stratford. Stop the train. Step into that room. Hello, I am Anthony Barnett, Norway's greatest jazz xylophone player. I saw you through the window. I saw you moving about your room, sitting watching TV. I had to come to say hello, to embrace you. We humans must stick together. The film breaks at this point. Crackling noises and smoke pour from the improvised projection room. The village priest rushes out, threatening the noisy audience to be quiet or else. If we sit quiet and still, we'll be allowed to see the rest of Sabu the Elephant Boy with French subtitles. He's called Bath Time. A motor torpedo boat, covered in giant bubbles, suddenly appeared through the early morning mists. It was only when it was almost upon us that we could hear the muffled roar of its engines, and then only faintly. I have as much knowledge of myself as I do of why I was adrift in that rubber dinghy in the Malay Straits. All the books and maps and knowledges give us too little, leave large blank spaces. Terra incognita. Citizens who work and find no peace in pain. I am chains. In chain numbness, not confusion, the war boat bears down on me, on us, where educated summaries are not worth a spit in hell. The Cambridge Marxists with large houses, cars and incomes can shove it. Anarchist field marshals, socialist judges, dialectic fuzz, switched on hangmen and all other benefits of correct revolutionary practice. I don't need patronage. I need something else. The mists clear before the burning sun. The sea empty and flat as a sheet of polished metal. The long day ahead. I want to finish this first half with a longish piece. I suppose it would be called a prose piece because the words go from one margin to the other, which consists of 10 prose fragments and a series of questions afterwards. The fragments to begin with are like two parallel stories. And the questions, I suppose, are echoes, really, of those school comprehension exercises one used to have, where you'd get a paragraph and you had to answer questions about it to see how well you'd understood it. And this could be in French or in English whatever, or Latin, whatever you like. Also, of course, there's echoes of that lovely thing I remember as a child, where you'd be told to write an essay beginning with a sentence, and then you'd be given a particular sentence and then have to complete it. I mean, it could be quite harmless, like this summer holiday I did, and so on, but it could be more tricky than that. So these fragments, in a way, could be starting points for each of you to complete a longer work or not. One, it's called The Beginning of the Story. The castle was built on a small hill overlooking the river. Probably it once commanded the whole valley. Chose who could pass through the valley, who could come up river in boats, who could cross the river at the nearby ford. Now it stands empty and the surrounding lands are once more scrub and forest. The castle, after all, was only built by men and manned by men. And now it's just one more feature of the landscape, though maybe more passive than most. Two, parting the leaves, you look out onto a sunny meadow that slopes down to a small wood with a stream at the other side. A thick wood border the meadow with the beech tree's branches trailing the ground. The leaves of one tree slowly parted and a face appeared. 3. Blue objects flashed before the eyes of the face, as though a giant blue boulder dominated the foreground and all else was only a haze. A rounded blue cylinder rising out of the earth or descending from the heavens. There are obviously many explanations and interpretations for all these stunning phenomena. 4. Late in the morning, on a mild and sunny autumn day, I was in the kitchen. First I made a delicious chocolate blancmange, then prepared a bowl of stewed pears made even more fragrant by a touch of ground ginger added to the boiling syrup before introducing the segments of pear. The quiet happiness one feels with such domestic duties is perhaps one of the greatest joys of having a home. The choice of dishes will obviously signify something to a person looking for such things. Whether he's right or wrong is of little importance to me. 5. Threading its way along the valley was a string of pack horses. One could just make out the small figure of the accompanying traders. Up here, overlooking the valley, perhaps they're not traders, or not all traders. Perhaps one of them is a magician. How to imagine his clothes? That is, if he dresses differently from his companions. And whether he should be a wizard rather than a magician. Whether, rather than these people merely being on a journey or trading, there are more serious and more exotic matters in hand. Threats of dragons? Threats of invasion by harsh forces? Or worse? Threats of the moon disappearing, of tides growing wild and ravaging the shores, flooding the valleys? 6. The wind moans about the house and the last yellowing leaves are stripped from the trees. The birds become more obvious and seemingly more active in their continual search for food. Trim the wisteria, tie up the jasmine and honeysuckle, restake the chrysanthemums, beware the gales. Trim the house, all shipshape, the winter almost upon us. 7. In his pouch the wizard had a small silver box. The box was beautifully engraved with curious designs and the suggested figures of birds, otters, foxes and wild boar. There was no apparent way of opening the box, though it could be opened by the wizard. Inside was a small flint blade and a flower that never faded. 8. A quiet and mild day in early winter. The sunlight in no way clear or bright, but somehow there. The garden below my window is all wetness. The last damp, yellowing leaves hanging from the wisteria. A small, half-dead pink rose is the only colour in the flower bed, other than the dull browns and greens of the dying leaves surrounding it. On such mornings, a similar lethargy fills us. 9. One clear night, the wizard stood alone in a small meadow beside the river. The moon was almost full and clearly lit the whole landscape. He placed the silver box on the grass and stepped back a few paces. The box then slowly opened as though of its own accord, and once open, a bright silver light burnt over the whole surface of the box, inside and out. And at the same moment as the silver box opened, a blue cylinder of light slowly appeared, hovering a few feet above the box. The blue light, at first faint, as the box's own light was, gradually generated more and more power until it was a near dazzling throbbing, humming block of blue. All this happened in silence, though somehow you sense at the edge of your hearing a small and delicate music, almost like the tinkling of glass wind chimes. After a time that no one could measure or remember, the blue cylinder of light began to fade until, in the end, it was the faintest of outlines, and then disappeared completely. And at the same time, the silver box's light also faded and died, leaving the box an almost indistinguishable dark object set in the pale, moonlit grass. 10. A great sadness fills us. Then questions. It's like sort of bedtime stories. Questions 1. Does the man go mad? Does he even commit suicide? Hence a well-rounded drama, or continue a life of quiet suburban despair? So a well-rounded modern drama. 2. Is the wizard murdered soon after this event, or several years later? Or does he lose his powers, slowly or quickly? Or the reverse, does he go on to become truly prosperous and renowned for his skills, living to a fine old age? 3. Late on a summer evening, we find ourselves in the leafy suburban streets of some small town whose name we don't as yet know. There is a velvet darkness that brushes our lips and cheeks with great sensuality. This darkness is only broken by the vague pyramids of white light around the rare street lamps, and the opaque yellow glow from some curtained windows where people are still about. The silence hisses and crackles, it is so near complete. 4. Shrieks of anguish are muffled in blankets. 5. Do we pour chocolate blancmange over the wise wizard, explain to him the while that it is a symbolic gesture attacking all he stands for, that he shouldn't take it personally? 6. Are we denied peace? Not the peace of answers, set ideas and realized hopes, stagnation, but the peace to do things we want to do for ourselves, to push on unhindered by jobs, exhaustion and the treacle of fears and evasions. 7. The man closes his book. Out of his window he knows and sees the seasons change. His guarded optimism is justified by events. And the last question, 8. Shrieking statues are suddenly muffled in the public gardens by council workmen. The flowers join in the horrified chorus. Why me? Who me? Not me. I think I'm going to have a how long break? 20 minutes or... Yeah, about 20 minutes, and then I'll read for another half hour. Being brought out as a pamphlet. The full title is Faded Ribbons Around the Lost Bundle, Now Being Devoured by Moths. And it's sort of homage to William Strang, who is a magnificent artist in the tradition of Sargent and Whistler, a Scot who was active during the early years of the century. There's a very fine exhibition of his work at the National Portrait Gallery a year or so ago. It's in 7 pieces, sections. Late on a hot summer's night in Central Park, at this point, creaking noises are heard as a faded and flaking cloth backdrop is unrolled, showing a star-filled sky and crude silhouettes of palm trees. A touch incongruous, but Two adults skip through the planned woodland to the children's playground, where they vigorously swing on the swings, laughing and talking all the time. Various constellations of white stars are set on the midnight blue, graphic fictions of the bear, Orion the hunter, the ladle, the plough. A special effects machine is working hard in the wings, pumping out a soft, humid air to match the scene. After their game, they amble somewhat aimlessly across the park towards the streets and buildings. Where next with the romantic rush that will possibly end in dissatisfaction and second thoughts in a disheveled bed in an airless apartment? Dawn approaches, the sky lightens appropriately, read the stage directions. A clear sky suddenly appears when I close my eyes. There are no clouds on this day. A monoplane slowly crosses the sky, returns, circles, then goes off in its way. A woman enters in loose, thin pants. Clouds, small white clouds, appear and cross from left to right. A spin of the compasses that stride off to Cologne, Hanover and Berlin. The dream on the close-cropped turf of the chalk ridge blurs, then fades into telephones and postage objects. A 14th century Italian painter, who specializes in gold leaf, appears at this point with his apprentices. There's much clattering of paint pots. Trestles are set up and pigments are ground in the mortars. Bright sunlight streams through the high windows onto the scene of noisy industry that, as the day progresses, will subside into the sounds of brush strokes and intermittent groans as men shift their cramped bodies. Days, months, even years pass, all for that day when the patron will enter and gasp with wonder at the finished work. Angels cluster and rustle just to the side of my vision. Years later, section subtitled Paris, sun streams through the window onto the table. There is fruit in the bowl on the table and flowers in the vase. The bare white walls gleam with that reflected sunlight. You open the window. The pleasure of summer days slides by, unnoticed, as though timeless, the days mingling. The trees rustle and sigh as the wind comes up. I touch your shoulder with my lips, and you then turn to me, smiling. The vines are doing well this year. The house stands firm, clear and fresh as it was hoped. Embraces seal the knot. The arrogant woman in the large red hat and bright green dress stares out of her gilt frame, a book held limply in her left hand. Liber generationes Jesu Christi fili David fili Abraham, son of David, son of Abraham. Black crow's feather lies on the moor's coarse grass. It's picked up and carefully taken to a house many miles away. A white and blue and red feathered archangel tramples the dragon and opens the loving scroll. Children joyfully rush about, gathering the short grey and brown feathers they've discovered in the hill pasture, happily ignorant of history and the death involved. Her pale and flushed face aches with tension. Anger and violence seethe like maggots beneath her glazed refinement. For one moment, to get up and stride about the room. Will she? No. She remains seated on a hard, high-backed chair. The questions of where vanity and obsession meet, or divide, or suffer little children to come unto thee. A starling's breast, crowded with lustrous stars, set on a black varnished night, and the angels all aflutter. And, washing the whitewash from our hands, we remember that Henry III's favourite decorative motif in both his castles and his palaces was gold stars on a green background. Work, he commands, must be decens, pulcher, sumptuosus. The sound of children laughing outside. Then gusts of rain and wind and a blur of colours signals the arrival of the rainbow door. We step through into a meadow of long grass, scattered with dandelions and dog daisies. A 13th century ceiling meets Schubert, meets a glass of chilled white wine and a ripe peach. The last part, which is subtitled The Progress of the Walk. Blackbird's song, skylark's trill, cuckoo's call, lush woodland, wheat field, re-entering the trees, an aeroplane circling, naked lovers, a blue butterfly, a small fragment of decorated pottery, the end. I want to read two poems from the book again. First one is a piece called To Be Read Very Slowly for Harry Guest. At two bells on the middle watch, unable to forget the cry of wounded creatures deep in the wood, the bridge in near darkness except for the yellow light, glowing from the compass, the instruments. Haunted by a strange dream of a wild and thick wooded country, a forested lowland with high, bare ridges looking down on all this, walling it in. The possibility of ruined buildings made of stone lying somewhere within this forest. In fact, such sights scattered like dying stars throughout the forest land. To wake from such dreams, sweating and in a tangle of bedclothes, to wrench open the porthole and fill your lungs with that clear sanity of sea air, to see the ocean again, sparkling with moonlight, reassuring us, always there. But when struck with that dark, hard reality of death, how the fear fills us again and again, whether awake or dreaming, both at the loss of all we love and hold dear, the gardens, the seacoasts, our families, and the loss of our hopes and dreams, of what we still need to do to find out, know, always hungry in the face of such hauntings. In the undergrowth of the wood, small creatures go about their business, the moss and lichen, the small, delicate ferns, flash and sparkle with their own movements in the night. Sleeping birds overhead. As you enter Fishguard Harbour, a cargo ship sits on the bottom, half submerged. Only the bows, bridge amidships, and the funnel and masts and the stern above water. Seaweed trails from the deck rails and rigging. Once ashore, you climb up atop the giant granite cliffs, their edges rich with cowslips, thrift and orchids in flower. The vast ocean in front of you, gulls wheeling and squawking in the bright air. This is not a dream. A short distance inland you find standing stones set in lush wheat fields. On certain mornings, as we turn a corner, an exquisite dew falls in our heart and then vanishes, but the freshness lingers, and this, always, is what the heart needs. Wrote Camus. And the other one I want to read from the book is called Afterwards to a Poem by Jack Spicer.
It's in memory of Bill Butler, who was an American poet who used to live in Brighton for many years. The poem, the first half of the poem, is in fact an extract from a poem by Jack Spicer, a San Francisco poet. He published a book called Book of Magazine Verse, and it consists entirely of poems he sent to unlikely magazines which have been rejected by those magazines. Like he sent his poems to baseball magazines or jazz magazines or all sorts of stuff, and they didn't want to know. And so he finally collected the whole lot and published them in a book which had a facsimile of the normal cover of Poetry Chicago, who had equally turned down his poems. This particular poem I'm quoting from is from 10 poems for Downbeat, a jazz magazine. Quote, "They've, the leaders of our country, have become involved in a network of lies. We, the poets, have also become a network of lies by opposing them. The BAR, which Stan said he shot, is no longer used for the course. Something lighter, more easy to handle, and more automatic. What we kill them with, or they kill us with, maybe a squirrel rifle, isn't important. What is important is what we don't kill each other with. And a loving hand reaches a loving hand. The rest of it is power, guns, and bullets." Unquote. Webs of lies upon webs of lies, a spreading mold of hate and viciousness, and death walking among us all, that mean spirits and the dishonest man now hold sway, poison us all with their intrigue and venom, where no hand of kindness reaches out to touch our lips as we pass, as though love were driven out of the town and only left a light in the quiet of a home. And you now gone 3 days with death. And now gone 3 days with death, your big bear hugs, your watch and chain, yourself. We have no words to talk of you, to tell our loss. Only the stuttered conversations on the phone, the broken phrases stood awkwardly round a kitchen, an empty cup in my hand. At this distance I praise you as the days grow darker, and know the impossibility and uselessness of such. You walked past tense, talked past tense, and with all the clutter we humans drag behind us, were dear to us." I read one more decent poem, and then read an excerpt from Wine Tales. This is again a text which I prepared with Ian Brown, the Brighton artist I did the first two posters with, in mind. He presented me with a loose envelope with pictures of various famous wrestlers, like people wearing sort of leopard masks and so on, and people like wolf children and various sort of freaks like that. And so the piece is titled Monster Masks. "Masked monsters stalk the land. Grey monsters gain the day. Trust me," said the monster. Who should? Why should anyone trust the monster as he delicately and handsomely dances the steps of his greedy desire? A personal tango with complications. Stroke my fur. Sniff my scent. Running naked in the rain, running round in pulsing circles in the clearing. Touch me, touch me, don't touch me, don't touch me, touch me, touch me, don't touch me, don't touch me, touch me, touch me, don't touch me, don't touch me. In a bare and spacious room, filled with light, the windows opening onto early summer, the quiet and clarity of thought, Descartes and the 18th century meet the wolf boy of Aveyron, around 1800. The noble savage of Aveyron. From a narrow window, the Minotaur gazes down on the lights of the city. On such evenings, the loneliness almost overwhelms him. trapped and hidden in his labyrinth. The maze as much a protection for him as a trap for his victim. The beast within. Aped by cheap comedians and actors, nervous commercial ventures, on a fine knife edge, feed some need. Beauty and the Beast. I now want to finish by reading some extracts from a prose book I've written with Rick Cadell called Wine Tales, which I mentioned earlier I'd used wine labels as a starting point for pieces. And in this case, Rick Cadell and I found we had a similar interest in this sort of material. And so he would select a wine label, start a story, send it to me, I complete it. I would select a wine table, start a story, and return it to him, and he'd have to complete it. And so the thing sort of zigzagged back and forth through about 12 wine labels. Then we took the whole text and revised it and made it, you know, more consistent, I don't know what the word would be. Which might be coming out later this year. In fact, what happened was that it was very interesting because it pushed you into writing about material you wouldn't normally touch. You might have various taboo areas that you didn't feel comfortable about writing about. And because you had to complete something, you're forced into dealing with this matter. And this happened to me. And there is, I mean, since there's so few of you who can talk in these terms, it's a very interesting exercise to do. It became more than an exercise. I created a character called Catherine McLaren, who was a sort of Scottish governess working in a Bordeaux chateau. And he made various characters. And at the end of it, we become completely involved in these fictions we made up, and I felt very sad about having to say goodbye to them when we finished the book. And we both felt this because we really got things going, you know, material outside ourselves. I'll start with, I read six of the labels. This is a Chateau Nordonnais afternoon. It is a Bordeaux wine. If anybody wants to look at the labels I've got in here reproduced. It's partly a pastiche of those sort of 20s and 30s novels where people would sort of come through the French windows and say anybody for tennis. But equally, it touches on other sort of materials, using cliche, but using a kind of raw stuff as well. I can't describe the odd gel. And it's received sort of strange reactions. Some people really liked it, and some people felt, well, why aren't you just playing for laughs? Why are these embarrassing bits? But the thing was, it's essentially walking a middle path in between the cliches and the hackney stuff, and the raw stuff. Catherine McLaren has been the English governess at Chateau Nordonnais for 4 months now. Yet her position still seems so strange. The daily life of the chateau seemed alien when she remembered her own upbringing and home life. The letters from her friends came from not only another land, but another world, one that daily seemed more a dream than reality to her. Though possibly it was the other way round, and the world of Edinburgh was the real one, while she lived in some dream she couldn't as yet understand. That afternoon she was sitting alone by the window of her room. A popular novel was lying unread in her lap while she stared out the window. Her right index finger kept her place halfway through the book. They were the neat and firm hands one would expect of a young woman like Catherine. Outside, rain dripped from the heavy, drooping branches of the ancient larch tree. It seemed as though this cold, late autumn drizzle had been falling for weeks, though it had not. Soon it would be time to go down once more and deal with the arrogant and precocious children of Monsieur Calvin. At this moment, the two of them were probably working their way through a book Catherine personally couldn't bear. As though to avoid thoughts of the impending lesson, she let her mind wander to the subject of Monsieur Calvin himself. Where would he return from Bordeaux? Where would she see him again? Be alone in his company? What would they talk of? And most of all, how close would their next meeting be to how she imagined it? The disappointments and shocks to one's vanity when the two didn't match were only too well known to her. Going downstairs, she remembered an afternoon soon after her arrival at Nodenay. She'd been out walking, and was returning to the house quite late. As she turned up the curving drive, she noticed someone standing on the balcony, watching her intently. It was a girl about her own age and build, and dressed exactly like her. In a moment she realized she was watching herself. Her mind saw not only the girl on the balcony, but from the balcony it watched the girl on the drive, and each vision was tempered by a wary, hesitant intensity. The girl on the drive lifted her hand to her mouth and gasped, and saw the gasp with the eyes of the girl on the balcony. They stood for a moment. Then Catherine saw her other half turn and walk inside. Her mind could follow her through the soft furnishings of the upper drawing room, follow her at every turn in the passages, and away down the back stairs, where it lost her. "I wonder where I am now," she thought. Piscot Entre Deux Mers, which is a sort of white border. "Entre Deux Mers, I still hear the squeak of your axle. Between the two seas we parted years ago. Now my children are grown, and yours? The bells on the church, the bell on the church has rung for years, unanswered. Small insects leap from axle to vine, destroying the future." This is a Spanish wine. It's one of those marvelous, pompous Spanish wines. It has a large label with all these medals. It's won at some exposition, you know. This is the 13th Exposition de Bordeaux, Diplôme d'Honneur. "What is this naked youth doing, sitting with what appears to be an elaborately decorated stick, held in a somewhat suggestive manner? And then this full-bosomed woman, who now appears at my side, waving a palm leaf? Or is it a rather frayed fern? Hello, sailor, indeed." Château de Grandbourg, which is a Grave. It's a very strange label. It has this, in the foreground, it has something with a bicycle and a dog, which you don't usually get. But this we did in two versions. "Château de Grandbourg, an epic of everyday life." He staggered across the moonlit lawn towards the window, where her anxious, searching face stared out. Her slim body seemed inept and clumsy in the expensive clothes she wore, her fingers pulsing at the window pane. He wanted to call out to her, "It's me, Paul, I'm back. I'm sorry about last time, but I escaped. I'm free now. I've come back for you so that we can try again." But the words died in his throat as her face, aged beyond belief, lit up in the joy of recognition. "Dear Linda, I just called to return the bike and the Bloxham book, neither of which did quite what I'd hoped for. We must discuss this sometime. Nobody was around except old Rusty beating up the dust on the path with his tail, so I left them in the summer house with all those bits of old pots. Hope you can find them. Love, Catherine." Château de Grandbourg Rewind. The fugitive was dragged from his bicycle by a fierce dog as he turned from the country lane into the drive. And miles east of here, the deserter was left bound to a tree with barbed wire by the retreating army. A young soldier, still a boy, lay in the ditch with his intestines sliding out of his shattered belly. He cried out for his mother as the officer stepped forward with his revolver to put the man out of his agony. The officer was, in peacetime, a teacher of mathematics and music in a small provincial town. "Walk joyfully throughout all the world and answer that of God in every man." A uniquely full and scented flavour particular to this region. Boredom and drudgery are directed to the tradesman's entrance. Silvana, this is the only German wine. Silvana Rhine wine.
gloom of a rainy Sunday evening in North Wales was easily dismissed with a large gin and tonic. Laying aside my copy of Pouch's Welsh Peaks, I leafed through a copy of The Countryman. It seems that Tweeds will be de rigueur in the residence lounge of the Plastet Guesthouse this autumn. My fellow climbers and I then proceeded to the dining room, where Major Hoover and his lady wife were already seated at their table and discussing the art critic Edward Lucy Smith and Catholicism. I was not quite able to understand the connection. We'd had a grand day climbing the Arans. After the steep haul up to Island Fadwy, we negotiated our way over rock outcrops and snow patches along the windswept ridge to Alan Benlin, the lesser of the two peaks. Later we descended by a more leisurely route, following a diagonal path across the scree slopes into the Hengwin Valley. Besides the natural exaltation that comes from such exercise, we'd also certainly worked up a good appetite. The main course of dinner was ham baked in cider, accompanied by reasonable claret. We then decided to have a bottle of white wine with our dessert, two of us choosing the chocolate mousse while the other two worked their way through a rather limited cheese board. Our host recommended a certain Rhine wine none of us had tasted before. We were not disappointed by this charming suggestion. During a lull in the conversation, my attention was drawn to the scene portrayed in the wine's label. It was a scene of contrasts. In the foreground was a populous city that bristled with castle turrets and church spires. Behind the city was a plain of empty fields bordered by a large and impenetrable forest. Beyond the forest rose a long and bare mountain ridge. Silvana, same label, different table. Major H was peeved that the party on the next table wasn't noisy enough to complain about. He was also peeved to note that the same wine he'd found rather sickly with his lamb, they were obviously enjoying as a dessert. Idly he stared at the label on the bottle before him and imagined himself in command of the rocket silos in those distant hills, scanning across the plain with field glasses towards where he, and he supposed the people on the next table, sat looking into the label. For no reason his mind threw up the disquieting image of two sturdy youngsters in red and green striding off up the forest path with their satchels and correctly fitted footwear, and not a thought for anyone behind them. "Hey! Come back! Don't leave me!" he thought, then stared around with embarrassment. "I wonder where they are now," he thought. And the last label, final claret label. Your mind is tossing on the ocean. You step through the picture frame and the spray hits you. The deck kicks under your feet and your heart soars. There's much to be done. What next, Captain? Your life or lives, the old griefs, very real at the time. What do they matter? Your rose bushes, snipped in the late sunlight. Who'll tend them, or your memory of them? Your mind is running nose down on a sea of ideas. You have dreamed yourself into the real world. And that too is illusion. My ships have all miscarried. There's no wound, no ache. Oh, you out there, approaching, you inside, sharing this window seat, sharing my life. For us there is no hurt. Does a single white rose and a glass vase on a bare window ledge say everything? And outside that window, a vast cobbled square stretches off to the waterfront. Grand buildings with elegant arcades border the remaining sides of the square. Ships at anchor sway with the tide and wind and strain on their ropes like dogs. At this point, two cherubs appear in the sky at the corners of our vision, puffing out their cheeks. An angel and a naked woman come forward carrying a large antique coat of arms. They're all preparing us for the voyage. We're to leave our memories and head into invention, into the unknown or vaguely guessed at, the fruit of old rumours and stories. But still in the cold sunlight of that room, sitting beside our bags, the steam rising from our small coffee cups, the memory of a land of box forests, you and Hazel
and the honeysuckle and daisies. Remember that could never be left. Yes, we were now in that enchanted calm where they say lurks at the heart of every commotion. Right, thank you very much.